Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to episode 13 of The Story Studio with your hosts, Luke Condor and Daniel Wilcox. Oh yeah. Here we go. Check it out now.
Welcome to The Story Studio, a podcast where an independent publishing company explores the world of self-publishing, independent art, and the future of storytelling. It's a show for filmmakers, writers, comic book makers, crowdfunders, entrepreneurs, creators, and anyone looking to tell stories in the modern world. My name is Daniel Wilcox, and today I'm joined by...
Luke Condor with a K.
And?
And Ben Errington with an E. Yep,
yeah, right. There is an E in there. Yeah,
there is one.
At some point, Dan, we should work out a harmony and do that intro together.
Oh, wow.
That would be...
Welcome to The Story Studio!
I was going to try them, but then I'm not going to embarrass myself with harmonies.
No, okay.
Well, I beatbox. Welcome to The Story Studio.
I beatbox over it as well.
Do that again, Dan.
Yeah.
Welcome to the story studio.
Okay. Professional as fuck.
That was beautiful.
So, today we're going to be talking to Mr. Ben Errington about his first novel that I know about. You haven't got any secret novels, have you, Ben?
No, I've got no... Well, yeah, I've kind of got a secret novel.
You've got secrets. Good.
I've got plenty of secrets.
The mind novels dark, count as terrifying. Secret novels.
Say again?
The mind novels count as secret novels, because I've got thousands in my head.
Oh, yeah, the mind novels. They're my favourite ones.
The mind novels. No. They've got to have a barcode, otherwise they don't exist.
So I kind of figured that, like, we've finished projects. And we should probably talk about what we've learned from doing them. I feel like once you finish a project, you should be able to come away with some takeaways. So I figured that's what we could do for not only this book, but other books that we do in the future. So Dan, when we've done ours, we could maybe interview each other about what we find from them, and we'll get Skip on to do one about Deeper Than the Grave, and we'll do one about El Marvo as well.
Yeah,
that's good.
But first, it feels super early. We don't normally record this early.
It's really early, isn't it?
There's actual daylight.
Yeah.
For all the people listening, you can listen to the daylight.
I can't hear
you
it.
You can listen to the daylight. It just feels good to be up this early on a Sunday, though, yeah?
Yeah. I tried to get out of bed at 8, and then I fell back asleep for about another hour or so.
That's all right. We'll let you off on a Sunday.
Yeah, thank you.
I got up super early, and I went for a swim.
You mean you had a bath?
Super early.
You've been for a swim?
In the bath. I went for a swim, yeah. So I'm all chlorine covered right now.
How many lengths?
How many lengths did I do? Well, I aim for about 50 at 25 meters. But sometimes I just get a little bit fed up. Or I always end up in the same lane as either someone who's incredibly fast showing me up or someone who's incredibly slow. And then I'm awkwardly like a foot behind them. You know, it's just ass.
The worst swim is when you're being beaten by like a 5-year-old dolphin boy. It's just lapping you constantly. It's insane.
Some people
have you ever been swimming and someone behind you who is faster decides to go under you?
Oh my God, no.
And they just appear out of nowhere. Just like,
do you grab onto their feet? Terrifying. Do you grab onto their feet and just go for a ride?
Just go, hi ho, silver.
Yeah. That's never happened. That's kind of weird. I've not had that.
Yeah. I've had someone like really close behind me, but they're so impatient that they're just like they don't care about just like nudging me.
Yeah.
They're swimming and they're just hitting against my feet and they're just like, I'm just like, just calm the fuck down. Just let me take over when we get to this.
I always feel bad when I kick people behind me. Just give them a quick boot in the face.
Yeah. I've kicked someone like in the lane next to me before. Like I've got a little bit, not sure exactly where I am.
Yeah.
How long are your legs?
My foot's got a little bit out of control and it's gone sideways. I've kicked someone and I've just, you know, I've just,
yeah.
I don't even say sorry.
Yeah. That's how I roll.
I'm a rebel.
Dan, what are you up to, man?
Editing, still cracking through. I finished the first section of They Remain. Because I've been listening to a lot of story structure podcasts and reading a lot of story structure stuff and just trying to see it in my head as the five main points of a story. So you've got your beginning hook. I'm going to just show myself up here. Beginning hook.
Inciting incident. The lock-in, then, I think it's called. Is it called the lock-in?
I call it the middle bit.
The middle bit.
And then you've got your all is lost moment, and then you've got your conclusion, if you're doing a series kind of towards the end.
Yeah.
I think I'm up to about just finished a second point. So we've just had the big inciting incident where it kind of pushes forward into the rest of the story.
Okay.
I'm really enjoying it. Really, the process and the way that we've been doing it just means that now I'm at this point and I'm going through the draft that you're doing. I just feel like I understand the story more and what it needs to do.
Yeah.
So it's just plowing through that, getting the edits done. But the weird thing is because when I do word counts, now I've gotten to the point that I know how long it takes me to do a certain amount of words, so I can almost predict how long it's going to take before I'm finished. Whereas editing is a completely different ball game. It's some bits are stickier, some bits are easier.
Yeah.
So it's working out in my head how long that's going to take and just trying to roll with it and learn.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same boat. I know what you mean when you say we planned each other's books and then we swapped and then we wrote the opposing book and now we've gone back to the original book. And just having that removal and then coming back makes it quite easy to, it just makes it a lot clearer. You know exactly, you have a better idea of what should be happening when.
Yeah. Yeah, you just get this, I think we said it before, you get like a bird's eye perspective where you can just kind of go, this works, this needs a bit of work, and then maybe there are a couple of things missing to connect the dots, but yeah, enjoying it.
Yeah, me too.
Have you guys changed the title of that?
Yes.
Yeah. we were going to call it They Rot because it seemed to work in the planning, but now it's less turning into less and less of a zombie book and more of a post-apocalyptic survival style thing. So
rotting.
There is some rotting, but that feels like more of the title to the sequel.
Call it, they rot a bit.
They rot. They've done some rot, and then but like we think that'll be the title of the second book.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first one seems to be a lot more of the human condition.
Oh.
And less of the actual rotters themselves. So.
So what are you calling it? You calling it They Remain?
I think
Brexit.
So.
Book one. Book it's one, the Brexit They Remain. Book.
That actually. That title actually did come to me after Brexit. So you know I do the story ideas every day. The day after Brexit, it's not exactly the same story as They Remain, but the initial seeds are planted at that point.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're going for They Remain?
I think so.
That's quite good. Yeah. I do like it. Is it just like people just going, no, I will not accept Brexit. Post-apocalyptic world now.
Yeah, they're still going on about Brexit, even though there is no EU anymore.
It's set 30 years in the future, but
yeah. Is anyone else sick of the word Brexit? Where did it come from? I swear when the referendum was like first put across, and then in the weeks leading up to it, the word Brexit didn't exist.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's like anything though, isn't it? I mean, I think I prefer Brexit to Bromain.
Oh my god,
it sounds just like.
Have you not heard that?
No, that was for the other side. That kind of sounds like, you know, come on, bro, man.
Yeah.
Sounds like an American bro.
Come on, bro. Don't you want to remain? Come on, bro, man.
Yeah, but Brexit, just the word. What I don't like is the word Brexit and then the play on words that like the media use with the word Brexit. It's agonizing.
It's awful. It's very clever stuff. Yeah.
So
what we do is we're going to take two words and slam them together. There we go.
I do that all the time to an annoying degree with Kat. Like, no matter what we're doing, I'll put words together and try and make puns that really shouldn't be puns. I'll enjoy myself. Yeah, he's like, that's the kind of thing. I'll enjoy myself, but Kat will just shake her head in shame.
The one that made me laugh was when I was at uni with pre-drinks after a couple of years became prinks. And I hate that. Absolutely hate that. But that just seemed to be a lingering thing. Who's up for some prinks?
Prinks. Pre-drinks is a bit odd as well, isn't it?
Yeah, just a little bit.
It's just drinks.
They are just drinks, yeah.
I have once done pre-drinks.
That's the night before.
Yeah, I didn't turn up to drinks.
Pre-drinks are dangerous anyway, aren't they? We've all died at pre-drinks and never seen the actual night out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had some Lambrini once before I went out. And I think it had gone off or something because, like, it's not even that strong. Yeah, but it was, I think I had like half a bottle, went out to the first pub, threw up and had to go home. It ruined me.
Was it Lambrini original or Lambrini raspberry?
Original, I think.
Original.
Raspberini.
Yeah. Raspberini. Oh, yes. There we go. Lambrini, I find, is just a bit, yeah, it's disgusting. A bit urinal. Nice. It's a bit urinal.
It is a bit urinal.
It's a bit urinal.
What have you been working on, Ben?
What have I been working on? I've got a couple of scripts going on at the moment. A couple of short film scripts that I kind of like. I'm just working through, you know. I'm probably on the second draft of one of them and the first draft of another. So, yeah, it's going pretty well so far. Both short films, both pretty individual. There was one that I was really enjoying and the plot was coming together for really well. Then I watched an episode of Black Mirror and it was so similar. there were just a couple of things that happened in it. I was just like, that's exactly the same. So I've gone back to the guy I'm working with on it now and we're going to try and kind of tweak it so it's not too Black Mirror-y.
I think I might know what you mean, which leads us on to... I reckon the big whoops of the week, because there's something I want to talk about in the big whoops.
Oh, look at that. That was smooth.
Segway. Yeah, so the big whoops of the week. Does anyone want to go first?
What a big whoop.
I'll go first. Why the devil not? Okay. My big whoop for the week is a South Korean zombie film called Train to Busan. I don't know if you guys have heard of this.
I saw the trailer. It looks pretty epic.
Did you see the trailer?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I saw the trailer, and I think I watched it like an hour later because I was like, that looks intense. And it was intense. It was really, really good. You're like, I quite like South Korean cinema anyway, but I've not really like kept up to speed with much over the last few years. Mm. I mean, I like all the classics and stuff, but I've not really kept up to speed with new releases probably for 3 or 4 years. So as soon as I saw this trailer, I was like, that looks really good. But it is a really, really sort of like unique zombie film, but it's also got like really good characters as well. It's a bit over the top, it's a bit over dramatic. But it's pretty terrifying as well.
Hmm.
I'd definitely give it a shot.
Is that on Netflix or is that?
No. I just found a stream somewhere. I was trying to see if it was like a cinema release or something, but couldn't find anything anywhere.
Yeah.
So, but I'm sure it'll be available to stream sometime soon. I think it's out in various. I think it's out minimal in sort of like release.
I bet they'll be like in like independent cinemas somewhere. Like there's always one quirky independent cinema in every city. I'm sure it'll be there.
Yeah, exactly. I was just feeling really impatient. The trailer got under my skin a bit and I was like, oh, I really want to watch that.
Yeah.
Even though the trailer looks amazing, the film's so much better. It's just got really good characters you sort of love, absolute despicable characters as well.
And what's it called again?
Train to Busan. And it's paced really well. And you know, like sometimes in these zombie films, you're just like, that is completely unbelievable. There's absolutely no way that would happen. There's no way these people would make those decisions. This film, you're like, it all kind of makes sense. It all sort of comes together.
Mm.
And the action's really good as well. And the CGI is great as well, because there are some ridiculous bits in it with absolute swarms of zombies. But it all looks really good.
Is it quite a high budget? Or?
I guess it's got a fairly, it must have a fairly decent budget because there's a lot of explosions and shit.
Yeah. What other South Korean films would you recommend?
Oh, God. Well, obviously, you've got the obvious ones like the Vengeance trilogy. So, Old Boy, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and Lady Vengeance. They're all good. All Park Chan-wook stuff's good.
Oh, have you seen, speaking of Park Chan-wook, I'm a Cyborg and That's Okay?
Do you know what? That's one I haven't seen.
That is amazing. I've got to say, it's mental, but it's amazing. Yeah, yeah.
Park Chan-wook, The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. Seen that?
I don't think so, no.
Pretty sure that's Park Chan-wook. Anyway, that's like a Western. That's ridiculous. Yeah.
There's a South Korean film I saw a while ago that's pretty mental. It was about a detective. He's after a serial killer, but he doesn't want to just capture the killer. He starts like torturing him. It is brutal.
I saw the devil.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, it's absolutely brutal.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is phenomenal. Yeah. I'll definitely recommend I Saw the Devil. Yeah, that's like a cat and mouse thriller. Or like a sort of serial killer thriller, but it's completely different to anything you could expect, because it's like when you catch the killer, you think, catch the killer, that's it. But this is just goes so far beyond that.
Yeah, and he catches the killer pretty early on. And I was like, oh, well, that's the film. But then that's the start. That's the inciting incident.
Another film I'd recommend, South Korean, The Host. Have you seen that? That's like a monster movie.
I think I caught a few minutes of it on like a late night Channel 4 thing, and I was too tired. But it looked pretty. It's like the monster movie, right?
Yeah. It's like a monster movie. Just some weird sort of like mutant monster thing comes out of a river, I think, and starts sort of like killing people, eating people. But that's really good. But that's the thing. I feel like one thing I like about it, South Korean cinema, is that it is just the characters, even in films that shouldn't necessarily be character focused. They always find a way to be really character focused and sort of give those films like a different edge.
Hmm.
Like standard monster films. I mean, how many monster films have you seen sort of like from Hollywood recently and you think, oh God, those characters are really good. Some are like, oh, I don't know. Modern, like the Godzilla, for example.
Yeah.
Can you really remember anyone who was in that? I mean, I know Bryan Cranston was in that, and so was...
But that's kind of the selling point, yeah.
Yeah, but there's Soldier, that Aaron... Oh God, what's it? The dude who played Kick-Ass.
Oh, really? Aaron Taylor-Johnson.
Exactly, and like, no one even remembers that. Like, I was thinking about it the other day, and I was like, oh my God, yeah, he's in it. Do you know what I mean? It's just forgettable characters. And I know that the monster is the main focus of Godzilla, obviously.
Yeah.
But with someone like The Host.
It's nice to have those characters that you can link to, relate to.
Yeah, I think that was one thing with Train to Busan, is kind of like you cared about people almost immediately, and even characters you didn't care about straight away. By the time it came around to them either dying or being in peril, you're like, oh God, I really do care about them. I don't want them to die. Or on the other hand, I definitely want that person to die. There is a character in Train to Busan, got to be one of the most despicable characters like of the year. You're just like, oh my God, die.
You've sold it. It's on my list now.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Check out, yeah.
Dan, what about you, man? You got a big whoop?
Yeah, my big whoop is that last week was the 1 year anniversary of Sins of Smoke for me. So that was the novella that I wrote in 2015 that kind of kickstarted everything that I do writing wise. I actually forgot that I put it on my calendar as a reminder, and then it popped up, and then obviously Facebook did it. Did you know that this happened a year ago? And I was like, yes, but thank you, Facebook. That's lovely. It's just, I don't know, I have a lot of fondness for that book, though. One of the things I've already found is that I'd love to go back and rewrite it. There are definitely some lessons I've learned in the last year that I'd take to that book and I'd recraft it. But at the same time, I don't really want to touch it because that was the book that started it all and that I did pretty well with. So,
do you, I was thinking about this the other day, when you first start like publishing and producing stuff, your scale of what you can do and what you want to do is quite small compared to, and it just seems to build everything you do sort of like opens your world a lot more. So you start thinking about like novels you can do, and then you start thinking about novel series, and then you start thinking about more than that, I guess, like making a bit of money from it or something, or it's just crazy how it all builds on top of each other.
Yeah. It comes back almost to that. When we were talking before about habits and starting off small and building up, to begin with, it was I did a couple of short stories, which I sent off to some magazines and stuff and didn't really do anything with. And then thought, if I could do this, why not try a novella? So that turned into an 18,000 word story. And since then, it's just been trying to push and do novels. So each baby step opens up your gate that bit further.
Hmm.
It was just nice having that pop up in my calendar.
How often, if at all, do you guys go back and read like stuff you've written, like your old stuff?
I never read like my old stuff.
No,
literally, once it's gone to print, I put it aside. I think I need to leave enough time to go back and look at it with fresh eyes, but I've not read Sins of Smoke in its entirety, at least. I've read sort of small sections, but...
Yeah,
no.
I try not to. I mean, there's a couple of times with The Hips from Outer Space. Read it so many times before it came out. Like, I just didn't want to read it again for ages. And I had to, when Ian did the audiobook, I had to, like, listen through it again. And I can hear, like, bits had changed, but I kind of like that it's like a time capsule of what I was writing like at that point in time. Also, when we started putting stuff on Steam, I put some of my old short stories on. And, like, I would not publish them now. Like, if I was writing today, I would not publish them. They're just not good enough. But at the same time, I don't want to change them because I'd like to see that progression in the next however many years, just to see how much I've changed and developed.
It's good to feel that, isn't it? It's good to actually... I think that's one of the things that motivates you, is if you can see that progression in... I mean, a year, you can argue, is a really long amount of time, a really short amount of time. In terms of writing, I see it as quite a small amount of time, a year. But the fact that you can see what you could do better and understand that in your own work is testament to the fact that you're constantly improving.
Yeah.
I guess it feels like a long amount of time, considering everything we've done in the last year. If you kind of if you'd published that and then a year had gone by and you hadn't done anything else, it probably would seem like a lot of time.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
What about you? Do you read yours again, Ben?
Not in full, exactly. With a short story that I did called Die Pack, when I wrote the sequel to it, I did go back and read the whole thing just to sort of refresh myself with different plot points and some of the characters. I did sort of see things that I thought, God, yeah, I definitely changed that. But I try not to think about it too much. I didn't try and dwell on it, so... other than that, sort of like longer projects, I've definitely like flicked through like books, like Ten Tales, for example. I've flicked through that and read like a page. But again, I can kind of feel that if I get into it. And again, I have read it so many times, obviously, when it was edited and everything, that I do feel a bit like, oh, I've read all this before. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. But yeah, I see plenty of things that I change, and it's a little bit frustrating, but you know.
I always find as a former editor that it's always a fear of typos for me. So I did actually, when Sins was released, it was a week after, I opened it to a random page and just went, oh shit, and just closed it because there was just a word spelt incorrectly. And I went back and I edited it in the CreateSpace file and the KDP file, but it was just that I was like, how many of these have been sold that are going to have that in?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the price you pay.
You can't dwell on that too much because that will kill you.
We've all noticed typos in like books from major authors, right?
Yeah, I've noticed those. Yeah.
So, I guess just think about that when you think about it, if it can happen to the best.
Yeah,
I found one in a book that I've got. Actually, wrote it on the shelf in the copy editing handbook. One of the most recommended books that I've ever found on copy editing, and I found a typo that made me laugh.
Wow. Oh,
maybe it was in there ironically.
Maybe.
It was a test. Maybe. You passed the test.
You passed the test.
Here's £100.
Yeah.
What's your whoop, Luke?
Okay, so I wasn't going to do this one, but I kind of have to. Like, on the last episode, my big whoop was Black Mirror Season 3. This episode, I'm going to do Black Mirror Season 3, Episode 2. Like, it's just, I've seen the first 3 episodes now, so the next podcast I might have to do Episode 4 or something. I don't know. But it's just such a good show. Like, I was a bit worried when I saw the first episode of this new season that it was going to be a bit more Americanified, but it's not. It's a bit more global, I guess. But episode 2, everyone's telling me so far that episode 3 is their favorite, which is the
And Juno Perez?
No, it's the Shut Up and Dance one.
It's
the one that I'm guessing is similar to your short film that you're working on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, yeah, you know a bit about that short film, so you must have seen that there were a few... There were a couple of actual bits
that I kind of
done. And an idea, including the big twist.
Yeah.
which I wanted to include.
Oh, that twist is pretty mental.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it. As soon as I was watching it alone. I had earphones on. My girlfriend was asleep next to me. And I just turned and sort of poked her. And I was going to say, oh my God, this is exactly the same. But yeah, I managed to.
When that twist
happened. Can you not pretend you've not seen it and just claim it?
God,
I think too many. Black Mirror is a bit of a phenom at the minute. I think you can't really get away with that now. I don't know. When that happened, that twist happened, me and Kat like looked at each other like, what the? That good. But I actually prefer episode 2, which is the playtest one. Like, it's the best horror film. And I say film just because it's an hour long, it's a self-contained story, it's pretty much a full feature-length film in a way. But it's the best horror film I've seen in so long that actually terrified me. Like, I watch horror films all the time, and they're about demons and ghosts and stuff that just doesn't exist in my mind. Like, I don't believe in ghosts, I don't believe in anything like that. But this like augmented reality implant thing that he gets, like some of the endings in it was so haunting. I just went to sleep that night just with it like playing on my mind. Have you seen that one, Ben?
Yeah, I've seen that one.
So there's like three endings in that episode. The first one, when he said he doesn't know who he is, that one really got to me, because it's like it could happen, like why? Yeah. And it probably will happen. Something crazy will happen like that at some point. But yeah, Dan, it's the most horrific thing, but like in the best way possible.
It's
like,
on my list.
Yeah,
I think is it the main dude? Who is he? The American actor.
I didn't recognize him, but I thought he was great. Like, he's such a likable character throughout
somebody
the
said
episode.
To me, so somebody said to me he was Kurt Russell's son, but I don't know. I might need to IMDb that.
Yeah,
I don't know if they were just saying he looked like him, but
he was he played the character so like so likable, like, and I felt so sorry for him at the end of the episode.
Just wanted a quick buck.
Yeah, just wanted to get home.
It was a good one. I think it was really well paced. The endings were, as you said, haunting. It was pretty intense, pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
I think maybe it needed a little bit more time to kind of like establish him in that house, seeing various things. Because it was almost like you saw a couple of things, then the girl he'd been interacting with came into it, and then it kind of just spiraled out of control. So, I mean,
it needs a bit more. If it had like an extra half hour, if it was a full feature film, then it could have had that extra half an hour to build that craziness inside his mind that's sort of building up over time. But yeah, I agree. Yeah,
it was great though. I mean, it wasn't my favorite episode of the series. By a long stretch. I think I tried to rank in my head the six, and then obviously you've only seen three, Luke. So you've got three unbelievable ones coming up.
I've heard, the one I've seen, I couldn't help but look at like some of those ranking lists, and the one that was on the top, they say it's Charlie Brooker's masterpiece. It's like about like I think it's like near future London or something. I've not seen it yet, but I can't wait. I really can't wait.
Is it Man versus Fire or something like that?
Maybe. I'm not too sure. But it's one of those. This doesn't happen very often. Normally, when I watch a series, I binge watch it and I just get through it really quickly. But I'm savoring them. So I really don't want to just like waste them. So I'm like, me and Kat are like watching one a night. And
I think I watched them all in about a week. Yeah. I didn't go crazy. But yeah, I think the three you've got coming up. So San Junipero is just like, it just, the vibe, just the atmosphere of it is so different to Black Mirror. Because with Black Mirror, every episode is like dread.
Mm.
What's going to happen? What's going to go wrong? What horrible twist is going to happen where you're just like, oh my God. San Junipero is just so, so different to anything you've ever seen on that show.
I can't
wait. But still kind of like fits perfectly into the world that they've created. I know obviously they're all different standalone stories. Just fits perfectly in there. And the other two, I mean, the last episode is like an hour and a half as well.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, you get a bit of time to sort of build with that. But
yeah,
I wouldn't say anything else. But yeah, check those. Yeah,
Dan, are you salivating at all? You should be
a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. No, it's I'm kind of at the minute. I'm so behind. I keep just seeing myself as that slowpoke meme. But just like I texted my mate the other day, going, "Oh my god, episode 10 of Jessica Jones is so good," and he was like, "Yeah, I told you 6 months ago." But no, I like to work my way through things, and Black Mirror is on my list after I finish Jessica Jones.
Well, the good thing about Black Mirror is you can just a la carte you can just like watch any episode like randomly because they're just their own little short stories. But I just can't
get over
having this.
Good things about it. I need to just put the time in and watch it. Yeah.
This season is better than the first two. It's like, there's two episodes I think from the first two seasons which I just absolutely love. Like some of my favorite stories of all time. But I think the season's just genuinely the quality is just better.
Does it inspire you to write more stuff for the other stories?
Yeah, I mean the other stories is a bit more fantastical, isn't it? We do a bit more of everything, whereas this is very focused on that techno paranoia.
Do you think that some of the other stories could very easily be Black Mirror episodes?
Yeah, especially some of the video game ones and some of the more
time travel ones.
Yeah, like the more sort of realistic, the more grounded episodes for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Let's pitch them for season four.
That should be an episode. We should do an episode where we all pitch a Black Mirror episode.
That could be cool.
That would be good.
So, should we move on to the main course of the episode?
Yes.
So, Ten Tales of the Human Condition. When did it came out? Christmas time.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Last year, right?
Yeah. Well, it came out last year, maybe. I think it was it before Christmas? I think it was like the 19th of December, something like that.
Right.
So, yes, it's coming up to a year that it's been out there.
Cool.
On its own.
And when was like the so that's when it was published. When did the initial idea come to you?
Oh wow. The initial idea would have been years ago. I reckon 2009. Cause I think in 2009 I was working with an artist to try and make it into a fully fledged graphic novel.
Yeah.
And then that probably took about 2 years to get about 15 pages done. It just took forever, you know. I mean, that was the pace that me and the artists were working at.
Yeah.
But then it got to that point, and in terms of the amount of money I'd spent, and the way the story was going, I was thinking I could probably just write this as a novel, and it's gonna, you know what I mean, I'll be able to say a lot more, and it wouldn't cost me as much.
I think it works as like a novel, potentially more than a graphic novel, but then again, I don't know.
There's a lot more in the novel than there was going to be in the graphic novel. The graphic novel was going to be quite, you know, it was only going to be about, I don't know, 100 pages. I say it only, but obviously as a standalone graphic novel, that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
It works in that kind of format because reading the actual story, you can, the characters and just the kind of action that is there, it's very, very high paced, and I could see it working fantastically as a graphic novel. But like you say, that's a much longer process. And
I think at that point when I was writing, I wanted to write for comics and I wanted to write my own comics. I didn't really want to write novels and anything else like that. I'd never really been on my radar. So obviously the experience of writing, in the end, writing the book sort of did turn me to wanting to write novels.
Yeah.
So what brought the mental switch from comic to novel, how was that? How did that work for you? Was it sort of easy to go onto prose, or was it a bit more difficult?
I'd kind of like experimented with prose in the past, and I'd written sort of like chunks of books, and I'd written stuff when I was much younger as well, where I'd kind of like been thinking, you know, I do want to write sort of books like that. But then making the transition then from wanting to be a comic writer into that, I think it was just as I sort of got into writing the book, as I was probably about a quarter of the way through it, it was then that I realized, oh, actually, this is probably a much better way of telling the story and probably a much better way of telling stories for me, at least. So I guess that's when the transition, I realized the transition was going to happen.
Although I don't sort of have as much experience of like writing, like publishing comic books, hopefully in the next few years, we will have a bit more of that. I have generally found writing books is way easy, or producing books is way easier than producing comic books. It's quicker, cheaper. Like,
yeah,
you could just get the ideas out there really, really quick. Whereas comic books, just I think I was reading an interview with Gerard Way, you know, the My Chemical Romance singer.
Oh yeah,
So he's a comic book writer as well. He is. He's basically.
Yeah, what does he write? Is it the Umbrella?
Well, he wrote that Umbrella Academy.
What's it called? Umbrella Academy, yeah.
But now he's got his own imprint within DC called Young Animal. He's got four comic books that he's writing, one or two. He's overseeing the overall production of this little line of comic books. But he said writing comic books and producing comic books is one of the most difficult things he's ever done. Like, even more than the My Chemical Romance albums, which are pretty epic. Like, you know, in the overall production, he was like the art director on those as well. And the videos and stuff.
Because then he was the art director. What's his story? Didn't he initially want to be an illustrator or something? And then he was traveling to New York. And I think he was around about in New York when 9/11 happened. And that kind of inspired him to kind of bring his friends together and make a band.
I don't know. I should look into that. But he seems like a really interesting guy. Even if people aren't fans of his music, they should check out his comic book work, because it's really interesting. He's doing more of like the weirder side of comics, which DC don't normally do.
Do you think part of that's in the collaboration process itself? So, like, if you're writing novels and stories, it is very much, if you wanted to, I mean, always recommend getting proofreaders and editors further down the line, but if you wanted to, you could easily just write from start to finish, book, pop it online, done. Whereas with comics, obviously, your strengths tend to either be in the writing or in the illustrating.
Yeah.
So I guess it's finding those collaborators who, you know what I mean, have got the same work ethic as you, got the same drive as well, can kind of like bring a story to life. Because obviously sometimes when you're working with an illustrator, they might seem like the right illustrator to start with, but then you get a few pages in and you're just like, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
that's not me saying from personal experience. Like, I can imagine that's what it's like. You know, you slave away over a script. And with characters and stories that you're, and then you put all the groundwork in trying to get the illustrator, and then they provide you with something. And I'm sure there's times when people go, not sure if
actually
that
this is what I wanted. Yeah. How did you find your original illustrator for A Box Able Sociopath?
I think I got in touch with him via DeviantArt. We've all dabbled a little bit of DeviantArt. I think I just saw his stuff and I enjoyed it. I think he was drawing stuff from the TV show Heroes at the time, which I think at the time I was really into that show. And I kind of like saw his drawings and just contacted him and said, look, I've got an idea for a comic. Would you be interested? And I just got chatting to him. And I think we were chatting for a number of weeks before we ever sort of made a start on it. But yeah, he was really good at sort of putting together. His name's Nino Harn Cajillon. He's from the Philippines. So yeah, he was really good at putting together sort of all the initial character sketches and everything. And then when he did the sequential sort of art, it was amazing. It was just black and white as well.
Have you ever considered turning 10 Towers back into a graphic novel?
No, not really. I kind of feel like I'm done with
finished
that.
With it.
Yeah,
finished with it. And it's nice because I've got the 15 pages that kind of like act as a, not really a prequel, but just like a little taster, because I've got that. It kind of feels like enough for me to have that alongside the book. I can always go back to it and sort of look at it, and you kind of like see the sort of characters there, which is a good sort of thing to have before you go and read the book.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. If you say, so the story came to you sort of years ago, 2008, 2009. When it came round to that process of turning it from graphic novel into book, did you kind of, because it's a very sort of high-paced action thriller type book, did you do any research around other genres? Did you look at what other people were doing, or did you just kind of go, this is a story I want to tell and just roll with it?
It was a bit, I've been reading a lot of like Chuck Palahniuk and Bret Easton Ellis, sort of stuff like that, sort of like quite high-paced, dramatic sort of thrillers with obviously a lot of violence in them. That was kind of all the research I'd needed at that time to kind of help me craft my own story. And as I said, because it was like the first book I'd written, really properly sort of sat down to write, I didn't really know what I was doing. So there was pretty much no planning. There was no mapping out of the plot or thinking about things. I kind of just had the idea of what I wanted to happen in my head. Maybe not even all of it, probably like 2/3 of it. And I just started writing. And that was obviously why by the time I finished, I had way too much.
what would you say like the biggest challenges were when you were trying to, in the writing and in the publishing process?
I think everything was a challenge, absolutely every step of it, because it was the first time I was doing almost everything involved, from the writing process, the editing process, to the publishing process. As I said, because it was the first time I was doing it, it was all brand new information. Everything was a challenge. But then that's good. It's good to kind of get over that hump of doing it for the first time.
Yeah.
And once you get over that hump, you know what I mean?
See, this is where I say, like, Sins of Smoke, it was that, well, my first experience with actually publishing was I'd written a play at university that did reasonably well grade-wise. I say reasonably well, I did very well. And I just kind of, being modest. I basically just threw that into a Word document and threw it online as a test of how to go through the process. Whereas I find it sort of almost inspiring, or not almost, inspiring that you had this, like, several hundred page book as your starting point, whereas a lot of people do tend to start with novellas or shorter stories to just get their head around how it all works.
I'm going to admit that Ben blew my doors open. Just something I say every now and again. But like when we first started at Hawk and Cleaver, I'd only been like writing short stories and stuff. And then Ben said, oh, I've got this like 110,000 word novel. And then it's only after that I sort of realized that it was sort of possible. And it wasn't long after that when I wrote my first novel, just because I knew that we could do it in a way.
I blew your bloody doors off.
You did.
Was it like, God, if that guy could do it, literally anybody can. Literally anybody can. Right, I'm getting down to it right now.
So
yeah, no, that's good. That's good though, because I feel like that. Obviously, once from listening to your podcast, like a couple of years ago, Luke. Obviously, when I first got in contact with you, that was the step I needed to take. It was almost like other people around me legitimizing the writing and the publishing process.
Yeah,
it did kind of give me that nudge, because there wasn't really anybody that I knew who was writing.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you actually had anyone you could talk to about the publishing stuff, or if you were just, you know, an island out in the ocean.
I was pretty much an island out in the ocean, yeah. And I was making smoke signals, and I made friends with a volleyball, and you know, it was difficult, but that was the thing. That was, I needed to make that, and I need to reach out to somebody initially to get, and then obviously I got a lot of knowledge from Luke. He told me a lot of stuff, and then once I've done that, then obviously can move forward with bigger stuff. So yeah.
So
that was kind of how I came across Matt, because I was writing, or just trying to get into the writing scene and meet people that were doing it, through a friend of a friend of a friend. I was recommended his book, The Jump, read that and was like, oh, he's an indie author, he's awesome. And then just on a whim, just sent him a message and got talking to him. So I think putting yourself out there and actually just talking to people, because I find that indie authors are very, very friendly and very happy talk about ways to do.
And there's so many ways to do it as well. Like sometimes it's good to have just like a, if you follow loads of authors on Twitter, sometimes I have a nice little short conversation, emailing people directly and just like asking them, you know, a world of questions. Yeah. I think, yeah, because people are always willing to, and I feel the same now, because I've definitely had, I mean, it's a bit of a shocker that people would, but people have kind of reached out to me and sort of said, oh God, how did you publish this book? I've written a little bit, a couple of people on my Facebook friends list I've done that, and then a couple of random emails I've had before. So it's good to sort of try and put across the knowledge you've gained and sort of help other people. Help other little orphans sprout out of the ground.
So they're not an island.
They're not an island, yet.
Yeah.
If you could go back, well, not so much go back, but if you were now to start and completely redo 10,000 Human Condition, what lessons do you think you've learned in that initial process that you're going to take forward? Because I know you've got a book planned for next year, which The Pursuit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything sort of major that you're taking forward from that you're going to carry over into that book?
Yeah. I think so. I think absolutely loads, really. Absolutely loads. Because I think with 10 Tales, I did just sort of, I used to sit down and just write so much, and there was no real, there wasn't really much substance behind it. It was kind of just writing pants in, as you say, just writing pretty much whatever came to me. I had some sort of idea of plot, but now I think mapping out plot is really, really important. Thinking about stuff a lot more. Because you know what I mean? I'd write plot points and sort of different things that the book could hinge on, and I'd write them, just they'd come to me and I'd write them immediately then. Do you know what I mean? There was no thought behind it.
Yeah.
I think now I'm going to put, you know what I mean, with anything I've written in the last year or so, there's a lot more thought behind it, a lot more planning. I like to write out really simple sort of like treatments of the whole thing, so at least I've got something to reference when I'm writing and when I'm sort of breaking it down as well. And I think a lot more about word count too. Whereas with 10 Tales, obviously, by the time I got to 110,000 words, which was a lot, I did obviously trim out a lot of that. I ended up at around about 75,000. So obviously, there's a lot to lose, but because there was a lot of waffle.
Mm.
So I think now I know, I think I've learned how not to waffle in my writing, I guess.
I do like when you do, you know, message with an idea and say, oh, I'm thinking of doing this, and then a couple of days later you almost bring out like a 2-page synopsis of what the story is going to be. It's really interesting reading those, because that's just a really good way to outline what it is you're doing and get the idea behind it and the gears rolling.
Yeah, yeah, I like to do that now. I don't know about you guys, if you do that with the synopsises or the treatments and write out sort of like start to finish what's going
to
happen.
I do to a degree, yeah. I mean, I like to, more and more nowadays, I like to create almost like a Hollywood elevator pitch of what the story would be.
And that,
every day, so one of my things at the minute is I try and come up with like a new idea every day. That's what I'm trying to get it to, the point where it's a pitch where I could give it to someone and they could, you know, visualize what the story would be. I'd like to get to that point now for myself when I'm writing a book. Did we do that with Project Dan? Dan, I can't remember. We sort of did.
We came up with initial just a paragraph of what the story could be and roughly the mechanics. But
yeah,
I don't think it wasn't anything detailed. I think when it came to actually writing the beats, it was I put bullet points for the key points I wanted to happen, but it wasn't so much a flowy, almost prose version synopsis of what the story was. It was more just like bullet, 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 bullet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that definitely helps because I forget stuff as well. So like I might think, oh, this is going to be amazing to put in like the second act, or this is going to be amazing to put in towards the end. And then unless I've got it there in that treatment or in that synopsis, I forget stuff.
Yeah, I think I had it on one of our Scrivener files. I think I actually had a little folder that was just called Word Vomit. And it was just like, this could happen and this, possibly this. Oh my God, what is this? And just kind of literally let my mind run free.
Yeah, I mean, that's important.
Yeah, definitely. It's good to do that. I tend to do that with like a dialogue rather than sort of having sort of like a sort of breakdown of a scene or something. I'd base a lot of my ideas initially on dialogue between, you know, usually two characters, sometimes more than that, but I'd write nothing else but the dialogue.
Yeah. So I've always been interested in that idea. I have thought of that because one of the first experiences of writing I did was stage scripts, and that obviously is sort of dialogues and stage directions. I've always wondered about crafting a chapter around the dialogue.
Yeah.
That's how Tarantino does it. I can't remember where I read, but he said when he's writing a scene, he'll just write 30 or so pages of them talking to each other to find out what they're actually going to talk about, and then he'll know what they're... That's why I think that's why his scenes are so dialogue-heavy. They're also they work in that way as well.
That makes very sense. Because I guess The Hateful Eight was you know what I mean, so much dialogue in pretty much one place as well. Yeah. The whole film for like a 2.5 hour film.
Yeah.
And you know, have you heard what? Sorry, change subject. Have you heard what Tarantino said recently?
Is he retiring after two more movies?
Yeah, two more movies and he's done.
I heard him say something similar a while back. Because I know he said he doesn't want to be. He wants to make a certain number of films and then just leave and have like a perfect record. Has it been a perfect record though? I can't think of any stinkers.
Everything I've seen of it has been fantastic.
There are no stinkers. The only one for me that I can't really call a film that I love is Jackie Brown.
Yeah,
a lot of people do love that. But apart from that, it's pretty much a perfect record, surely.
Have you seen True Romance?
Oh yeah, man.
He just
wrote that, didn't he?
Yeah.
True Romance is definitely up there in my top 10.
I know some people. I mean, I quite liked it, but Death Proof, I don't think was as wildly loved as some of his others.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I did like Death Proof, but it didn't feel because of that whole Planet Terror, Death Proof, Grindhouse, weird thing that kind of like in some cinemas they were both together and then they were like separate. Because of that, it did kind of like knock it back a bit, didn't it? It didn't seem.
Yeah.
But then I think as a film on its own, it is really good.
Yeah.
It's probably not nowhere near one of his best, but
he's talked about how Death Proof and Kill Bill, maybe a couple others, are films within his film universe. So like he has Pulp Fiction and the World War II one, I can't remember what it's called now. But they all take place...
Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, they all take place within his Tarantino-verse. And then the more film, sort of pastiche ones, I guess, are like films that take place, films within his Tarantino-verse, which is quite interesting.
Right, yeah. Well, because obviously in Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, you've got Vincent Vega, so John Travolta's character, and Michael Madsen's character from Reservoir Dogs are brothers, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. I like it. I like that idea of building a universe.
I've heard a few more sort of like funny little rumors about people who might be related or people who might have met each other.
Yeah.
So would you recommend writing the dialogue as a good technique to try, or do you think that's kind of difficult?
Obviously, it depends what works for you. But in terms of some of the stuff I'm writing at the moment, a lot of it hinges on the dialogue, especially like in the last couple of short stories I've published. I feel like it hinges on the dialogue. So I've kind of like written the dialogue for a couple of key scenes that are like anchor points that I know are going to kick off this sort of section of the book. And then we need to eventually get to this dialogue. I mean, and then once I've got the dialogue there, it's quite good to kind of like link it all together.
Mm. I'm going to try it. I would say I've noticed that the best dialogue I see consistently is in comic books. I don't know why it is, but because I guess because it's so important, like it's not hidden within other text. It's just so out there. But the dialogue in comic books is normally spot on. And if it's bad dialogue, you can see it straight away. But
the only thing I don't like about sometimes in comic book dialogue was when I read the Civil War graphic novel. There's a lot of exposition in just pointing out who the characters are, which I get they have to do.
Yeah. I was going to say exactly the same thing then, Dan. I was going to say exactly the same thing.
Yes, you're right there, Tigre. And then all this other stuff. And you just...
Have you guys read The Walking Dead, much of the comics?
Yeah, I got all the way to the point where it jumps forward like 5 years or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What, when with the Negan stuff? I always find with The Walking Dead, I mean, I love it. It's one of my favorite comic book series, but I always find sometimes the dialogue in that feels really exposition heavy and it just doesn't feel like how people talk.
Yeah.
It feels like people are so, they talk like so matter of fact and they explain things so like succinctly. You're just like, people don't really talk like this, but then it'll go the other way.
Yeah.
Some of the scenes are like really good. And with the Negan stuff, I really didn't think it would transfer to live action very well, the way he spoke and the way he kind of like, I thought, no, that if they rip lines directly from the comic book, it's not going to work. But then obviously with the season 7, premiere with Negan, it just, he said stuff that was exactly the same as in the comic books, and it just worked so well.
Is that because Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who's like delivering the lines?
Because he's good as a bastard. Isn't he?
Yeah.
But that reminds me a little bit of Suicide Squad and some of the exposition, and that the dialogue doesn't feel organic, especially on the screen. Like one part, and I'm not going to like dive too heavy into it, but one part with it's Katana, isn't it? With the, is that her name?
With the samurai sword, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and she's kneeled over, clearly whispering to spirits, and then one of the guys turns around and goes, she can talk to the spirits in her sword. And we're like, yeah, you can tell that. You don't have to say that.
Yeah. What I don't like is when films that are a sequel to another film constantly deliver like exposition in the, as if to explain what came before. It's just like, well, if you're a sequel, it's pretty likely that the person, that whoever's watching has seen the first one.
Yeah,
we just don't need this exposition. Do you know what I mean? That's sort of something that. What I saw some recently was a lot of exposition. Oh yeah, Doctor Strange.
Oh, I've not seen
Doctor
it
Strange.
Yet.
Oh, have neither of you guys seen it?
No,
not yet.
Because it's an origin film, an origin story. There's a lot of exposition, but it is good. But do you know what I mean? The constant explaining of all these ridiculous, crazy things is a bit too much at times.
Yeah,
it does feel like, but I guess with a Marvel origin film that you want to fit into like 2 hours, because they're not just introducing a new character, they're introducing a whole other
playing side film of the universe. Yeah,
so far, yeah,
yeah.
I'm quite excited because Doctor Strange is always been one of my favorite characters in the Marvel universe.
I've never really been massively into him, to be fair.
There's a like a run recent. I think it's just coming to the end of its 12 issues now. But it's not brutal, but it's really dark, and it's like about how Doctor Strange, when he uses the magic, he sort of corrupts his soul as he uses it, and it's such an interesting take. It's quite funny as well. But it's if anyone was going to get into Doctor Strange, I'd say read that first, because it's a good run.
Yeah, yeah, I would like to check it out, because I did enjoy the character. The only thing I've ever really seen of the character, though, I'm quite a layman when it comes to Doctor Strange, is just him in other stories.
In
bigger sort of like Avengers stories or like Civil War.
We need someone that can do something more than their powers.
Yeah.
When they need something fantastical to happen. It's like he's quite big in the Infinity Gauntlet, isn't he?
I think he will be in the films as well. I think they've introduced him at the right time, because if they did him earlier on in Phase 1, it would have been a little bit too ludicrous. But we're all ready for it now.
Yeah, we've got Guardians of the Galaxy. That's going to like set everything up for pretty much anything, isn't it? Any kind of, because I think initially it was kind of felt rooted in reality, didn't it? Until we started getting Thor.
Yeah,
which I guess was quite early on.
Yeah,
well, yeah, especially with the first Iron Man.
Yeah.
Do you have any plans with your books? I know you've got a couple of sort of novella series, but do you think you'll look at doing any full-size novel series?
I don't know, really. I've not really had an idea that I think can span across more than one book at the moment. But I'd definitely be open to it. I think so.
You can create your own multiverse.
I'd love to create my own multiverse, yeah. That sounds exciting.
So we've been talking for like an hour now, so we should probably start to wrap up. But before we do, we need to do some quick fire questions.
Quickly, please.
Are you ready?
Before.
you know how this works, right, Ben?
I know how this works, yeah. Are you going to give me two options? I have to tell you which one I like the most.
To a degree.
Some of them.
Yeah.
To a degree, I'm terrified. Yeah.
Dan, do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
I'm trying to work out in which order to go, because I'm not sure how to pronounce one of them.
Oh, well, I'm not too sure either.
I'll go second.
Okay. All right. You ready, Ben?
Wait, no, I've done that wrong. I'll go first.
You ready, Ben?
Okay.
I'm ready.
Go.
Okay. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Whiskey or vodka?
Whiskey.
Last person you sniffed?
Myself.
Black Mirror or Breaking Bad?
Oh, Jesus. Black Mirror, I think.
Oh, really?
Word?
Yeah.
Eastern Alice or Palahniuk? That's the one I didn't know how to pronounce.
Palahniuk, I think.
Palahniuk, okay.
Just about.
Singing or dancing?
singing, can dance at all.
I've seen you dance in a sort of metal core way. best film?
Best film, Jurassic Park.
Oh, nice. Spirit Writer.
Spirit Writer. Palahniuk, I think.
Noise you want people to make when they receive news of your death.
Yeah, that.
You wanted to laugh.
Yeah.
Perfect. Cool. Okay. I think we're about done. You can buy 10 Tales of Human Condition from all good Amazon stores, but you can also get the, what do you call it, Ben? Like the pack with the graphic novel accompaniment.
Yeah. So the graphic novel accompaniment, sort of, what would he say?
Package.
Mega pack.
Yeah.
Mega pack. Like when you buy a sticker album and you've got stickers already in it.
Yeah.
It's like that. It's like buying the novel and then you get the graphic novel as well.
Is that's where is that? That's on your Big Cartel at the minute.
Yeah. So there's a Big Cartel, which is 10 Tales of the Human Condition, a bit long. bigcartel.com, I believe. But everything's on Amazon as well.
Cool.
And where can people find you on social media?
Twitter, which is at Ben_Errington. I've got a Facebook page as well, which is facebook.com/BenErringtonWriter. And all over the old Hawk and Cleaver stuff as well.
Yeah.
All over it.
So I'd suggest people go to hawkandcleaver.com, and also maybe if you like what we do, if you dig us, can you dig it? Is something I'm asking you right now. And if you can, go to...
can you dig it?
www.hawkandcleaver.com/thebirdcage, and you can keep us making stuff and keep us doing new stuff.
Hell yeah.
Sold.
Dan, have you got anything you want to tell people about?
No.
Yeah, screw you guys.
No, just the usual. HawkandCleaver.com. Sign up to the mailing list and get yourself a free book as well. And yeah, listen to the other stories.
Shall we also say that Tom Robson, the composer for the other stories, recently released a soundtrack from the podcast. So there's probably 10 tracks of deliciousness.
It's about an hour long. It's a long soundtrack. It's good to write to, good to meditate to.
Yeah.
Have sex time to, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, that's on Bandcamp. I think it's Tom Robson Bandcamp. If you just search that, you'll probably find it.
Yeah, and I'll link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah,
we'll link to it. Fantastic writing music.
Yeah, cool, okay. Beautiful. Gonna hit the stop button in 3, 2, bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Story Studio podcast. Still hungering for some podcast goodness? Then why not check out our other show, The Other Stories? Oh, and did you know, every time you leave us a review in the iTunes store, a puppy is born. Cute, eh? Anyway, toodle pip.
No, don't. Okay. Do it with a mouthful of biscuit. Spit.
Hello, and welcome to the Rory Studio.
Wait. Hold it. I enjoyed that.